We're holding in Gitin on page 8, at the bottom, Oistes. Like we learned about yesterday, a good part, most of this perek and most of the following perek talk about various takonis that the Chachamim made b'nei tikkun ha'olam in order for society to function well. One of them had to do with a get, which is what it's doing in this Masechta, but the rest of them are on other topics. So one of the famous takonis that the Chachamim made, b'nei tikkun ha'olam, is the concept of a prusbul. The Mishnah in Shavis mentions that Hillel HaZaken saw that people are reluctant to lend money before Shemitah, and that would be, and with that they're being over on an Issur D'oraisa, which specifically warns not to do that. So therefore, he came up with the concept of a prusbul, that this way a person will be able to collect his debts after Shemitah. It's based on a concept, D'oraisa, which is that if a person before Shemitah gives over, before the end of Shemitah, whatever, gives over his actual loan documents to Beis Din and gives it to them to collect, then it's not Meshamet. It only, because Shemitah applies only to private people. Basically, what Hillel did is you don't have to give over the actual loan documents, the actual shtaris themselves to Beis Din. It's enough that you write out a shtar prusbul, or even nowadays, we don't even necessarily write out a shtar, we just say it verbally, whatever, and it's considered to be in Beis Din's possession, all of the chovas, and then they can, and we're telling them that you can collect it on our behalf. Well, so the Gemara has a long sugya on the ins and outs of it. At one point, Shmuel says, the whole concept of a prusbul, he says, is ulbana de dayoni. So which the Gemara deals with the question, what does ulbana mean? It's the ulbana of the dayonim. So the Gemara says that has two possible meanings. Ulbana can mean something chutzpedik of the dayonim to do, that we should take, after all, a din and a mitzvah in the Torah of shmitas ksofim and override it using such a weak mechanism. So fine, Hillel in his times had to make a takona. For that purpose, Shmuel was saying it's not necessarily that we should be doing it that way for all time. And Shmuel says that if I had the ability, I would be mevatel the whole concept. So that's one possibility. The Gemara says that ulbana can mean a chutzpedik thing. The other possibility, or shameful thing, whatever. The other possibility is it can mean something of convenience, meaning, in other words, it was made really only for the convenience of the dayanim, because otherwise, come the end of Shemitah, they're going to have a line of people coming to give them their shtaris, and therefore, so that for their convenience, the Chachamim, Hillel, and his Beis Din made this takana, but nevertheless, Shmuel says, maybe it's not really so necessary. So, the Gemara says, how do we know? What does Shmuel mean with that expression, ulbana de dayoni? So the Gemara brings a proof from, which is here in Ein Yaakov, from a different context in which we find that same shodash ayin lamed vase, and we see that it means chutzpah, or that it means chutzpah, namely Omar Shmuel or Ula aluva kala shazinsa b'seich chupaza. Page 8 in Gittin at the bottom. So aluva kala shazinsa b'seich chupaza. How shameful and how chutzpedik is the kala who commits znus right there in her chuppah. Referring to the Jewish people at Har Sinai. Here we're at the chuppah with Hashem. We just received the Torah, and we're already making an egel. So we see that Shmuel or Ula is using the word aluva to mean chutzpedik. So therefore, yes, in his expression ulbana the dayani, he means it's a chutzpah that the dayanim should be doing such a thing on an ongoing basis every shmita, arranged for a prusbul. So the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Mori bro de bas Shmuel. Rav Mori, the son of the daughter of Shmuel, said. Now he's called that. Here he's called Rav bro de bas Shmuel. In other places he's called Rav Mori bar Rochel. Elsewhere we find what happened was Shmuel's daughters were taken prisoner by goyim. One, maybe more than one of them, was raped by the goy who had captured her. And she became pregnant from that. Afterwards, this goy actually became a ger. And we find him mentioned here and there in Shas, because his name is Issur Giyora. So their son is not considered his son, la halacha, even though biologically he's his son, because he was conceived when his father was still a goy. Therefore, the son grew up to be a distinguished Talmid Chacham in his own right, but the Gemara sometimes calls him Rav Mori bar Rochel after his mother, or other times, like here, it calls him Bro de Bas Shmuel to trace his yichus back to his chosh of a grandfather Shmuel. Anyway, he says, Mikra, where's a pasuk that we see that, where we see that that concept expressed of how chutzpedik and shameful it was for the Jewish people to do such a thing? In Shir Hashirim, there's a pasuk, Ad Shamelech b'Mesibay, while the king was still at his banquet, Nirdi Nosan Rechai, my nerd, which is a spice like you have in the Ketores, Shiboleth Nerd, Nosan Rechai, gave away its fragrance. Rashi explains that Nathan, literally you would think it means gave, as in gave forth, but no, it means here it abandoned, it gave up its fragrance. As we find, sometimes the word Nathan means to let go. So we see that we see that Shlomo in this pasuk is expressing the same point. He, Hashem, is still at his banquet with us at Har Sinai, and already my fragrance, my nerd, already abandoned, my spices abandoned their fragrance and were not what they were supposed to be anymore. Omar Rava, but Rava says, Adayin Chavivusahu Gabon. Nevertheless, you see that. Nevertheless, you see how precious we still are to Hashem, that even though the Pasuk is mentioning this point about how badly we messed up with the Chet Egel, nevertheless, Hashem expresses in this Pasuk his love for us, because after all, it doesn't openly say that the Nerd went bad and smelled bad, which it could have said. Instead, it uses the word nosan, which, yeah, I mean, here we're understanding the word nosan to mean that it gave it up, that it no longer had it, but still, instead of using something more openly like hisriach, instead it uses a nicer word like nosan, which we could also understand to mean it gave forth its fragrance in the positive sense. Tosfos actually points out, I mean, it wouldn't be necessarily saying hisriach. The Torah does try to use nice language when possible, but at least it didn't have to say nosan. It could have said ozav, which would more clearly mean that it gave away its fragrance, and instead it uses the word nosan, which can have a double meaning. It can mean to give forth, or it can mean to give up. So we see, in other words, that the word aluva means chutzpahdik, means an embarrassment and a chutzpah. Marshall, by the way, deals with the technicalities of it. I mean, really, at this, when it comes to Bnei Noach, then the akala in the chuppah, they don't really have among Bnei Noach the concept of marriage. The Gemara discusses in Sanhedrin, they don't really have a concept of kiddushin or chuppah. There's only when they first had relations, then she's considered married. And here they hadn't, so to speak, consummated the marriage yet between Hashem and the Jewish people. But Moshe is still on the mountain after all. Is only like kiddushin. So, nevertheless, still, and it was a shameful thing for the Jewish people to be doing it at a time like that. So the Gemara brings now another statement that also uses the Shurdash Ayin Lamed Vez, that also referring to chutzpah and to insults and embarrassment. Tanan Abanan Hanei Lovim Ve'enim Ervin, people who are embarrassed by others, who are insulted by others, Ve'enim Ervin, but they don't insult back. So again, we're seeing that the word olav means to insult and to be chutzpahdik. So other people are chutzpahdik to them, and they're not chutzpahdik back. Shremim chepasim ve'en meshivim. They hear people shaming them, and they don't respond back. Oysim me'ava. They do things for out of love for Hashem. They do mitzvahs out of love of Hashem. Usmeichem b'yisurim. Not for the sake of schar and not because of fear of punishment. Usmeichem b'yisurim. And they're happy for the yisurim that they get because they realize that these help clean up their averus. Aleihem akosav omer. On such people, the pasuk says, va'oyhavav katzeis Hashemesh b'gvurasai. Those who love Hashem are like the sun when it comes forth in its full strength. So here, Bapashlis, the Gemara is bringing this in, again, because it's another example of the Shurdash Ayin Lamed Vez, also meaning insult or chutzpah, just like we had with just like we had regarding the Prusbel, and just like we had regarding the Jewish people and the Chet Egel. So the connection between all these midyas, Marsha points out that all of these are part of oyhavav. All of these are aspects of loving Hashem. When a person doesn't respond in kind to people who insult him, they insult him and he doesn't insult him back, then it must mean he's ohuv labrius. People love him. People love a person with good midyas like that, and therefore automatically, as it says in Pirkei Avos, anybody that ruach habrius noichaymenu, that people like him, then Hashem also likes him. So therefore, then he's oisin me'av. Exactly what it sounds like. He's acting, he's doing mitzvahs out of love of Hashem and not for any reward. Smechem b'yisurim is also that he accepts the yisurim with love. So therefore, so all of those things go into the definition of v'oyhavav. And then Marshall goes on to say, the point is, just like the sun has an effect on the entire world, the same way, like we have in the Pasuk, in Kapitel Yud Tes of Tilim, Ve'en Nistar Mechamosen, nothing can hide from the sun's heat, the same way, such a person has dominion over everything in the world. There's a lot of other points that various Mephoshim talk about different angles within this. The Reef explains that the Reef over here explains that it's like this. Hanei Lovim Ve'enim Ovin would mean that they don't answer back with insults. Shemim chepasim ve'enim meshivim means they don't respond with anything at all. Now, they don't necessarily have to respond with an insult, but after all, a person is insulted or treated badly or whatever, they could, after all, respond back, or what do you want from me? That kind of thing. So, Shemim chepasim ve'enim meshivim, he doesn't even do that. He doesn't try to justify himself or whatever. He just accepts it quietly. And then he accepts it with love, and he's happy with the yisurim because he realizes again that these yisurim will help be a kapara for him. In fact, the Rif says the context of this pasuk is at the end of the shira of Devora, after she and Barak had beaten Sisera and his army. She said a whole shira, which we have as the haftarah of Parshas Peshalach. We have the whole story and the song as the haftarah of Parshas Peshalach, and she finishes off the song with these words. The Rif says over here, you think about it, Barak was kind of in that situation. He was kind of he got the short end of the stick over here. That here he's supposed to be the leader of the victory, but in fact the victory is credited more to Devora and to Yoel than it is to him. So therefore, he's an example of an Elovim v'Enem Ovim. He's being treated a little disrespectfully, and he doesn't answer back, and he doesn't say, wait, I deserve more credit than I really got. So she puts, at the end of the shiur, she puts in this compliment to him that he really personifies these midas. There's a lot of points that various Mephoshim talk about why Dafka, the comparison to the sun. There's an interesting thing from the Sefer Akedas Yitzchak that gives a couple of reasons behind it. One of them is, when you have an eclipse, when you have a solar eclipse, the moon is blocking the sun's light from us. The sun ought to be insulted. My job is to give light to the world, and here you're getting in my way, and what, you're thousands of times smaller than I am. What are you doing hooning in over here? But it doesn't. It goes in and does its thing. It still gives light to the moon, and it still, eventually, after the eclipse is over, it continues to give light to us. So therefore, that represents this person who acts like this. There's also, for example, there's the idea. We know famously that the moon complained, it's impossible that I and the sun should be the same size, like he wants the sun to be diminished in size, and instead Hashem diminished the moon. So again, therefore the sun is hearing the moon complain and doesn't answer back and doesn't say anything. So therefore a person who is like that also deserves to be compared to the sun and to have the intensity and the strength of the sun. It's brought, by the way, in Sfarim, that it's brought that a person who's like that, who's insulted and doesn't respond back, has tremendous power, in particular, to give brachas. They tell a story involving a couple who, for many years, weren't having children. They went to some gadol. I think it was Reb Chaim Kanevsky, but I don't remember for sure. But anyway, he told them, find such a person where they're insulted and they don't respond back, and ask them for a bracha. And it's not so easy to find such a person, but eventually they found and asked for a bracha, and sure enough, the next year they had a baby. The Gemara continues. My prusbul. Why do we call the sakana of getting back to the prusbul now? Why do we call it prusbul? Omer of Chista prus bully ubunti. It's a prus, which means a takana. Further on, the Gemara it meant, which is not here in Ein Yaakov, it mentions that Rava one time heard somebody speaking a foreign language, Greek, and he asked him in his language, "What does prus mean?" And the guy said it means like the fixing up, the takana of the matter. So it's a prus. It's a takana bully ubunti. For the bully and the buti, which the Gemara is going to explain, means the rich and the poor. Bully elu ashirin. The word bully refers to the rich people. Now, it's not because in English you have the word bully and rich people bully people, maybe, but that's not the reason. In Greek, actually, the word bully means something like the noblemen, the aristocrats, or whatever. So therefore, so it comes to mean the rich people. Dichtiv, as we find a pasuk in the Torcha in Parshas Bechukosai, Hashem says, "V'shavarti es go'in uzchem, I will break the height of your strength." The Tonei Rabbi Yosef, in the bullois to be Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef explained that meant the rich people in Yehuda, where until now they were helping support the people. We're going to have soon, in the next day or two, we're going to start the Agadah about the Churban, where you have the story of the three famous rich people in Yerushalayim, Nachdimin Ben-Gurion, and Kalbus of Ben-Kalbus Savua, and Ben-Tzitzis HaKesis, who were ready to supply Yerushalayim with food for a multi-year siege, and then their power was broken, and in the end, there was a siege and there was a Churban. So we see that the word Bulois means rich people. Buti Elohanim, and the word buti refers to the poor people. Dichtiv havet tavi tenu, as the pasuk says, you should lend a fellow yid money, and who is it that usually borrows money? Is a poor person. So ha'avet, you have the vase and the test over there. So therefore, buti means the poor people. So in short, we call the takana prusbul for short, but the full name of it is prusbuli or buti, which means the takana for the rich and for the poor. It benefits both of them. The rich person is that way not over on the Aveira and the Torah of failing to lend a fellow Yid money before Shemitah, and he also gains that he's going to be able to collect his loan after Shemitah, and the poor person gains because now people are willing to lend him money even close to Shemitah, knowing that they're going to be able to be paid back. Marsha points out also, you know, you have it's also kind of a play on words, because lamed and tes are both, you pronounce lamed and tes, both of them, you press your tongue against your teeth or against the ridge just above your teeth. So therefore, those two letters, in other words, come from the same, it's called the same moitza peh, they come from the same point of articulation in the mouth, and therefore, so we wanted a word that where you have almost the same word for rich and poor. So this way, so again, the Prusbel benefits both of them. As opposed to, Marsha says, by the way, what happened was, when we say, the Shavartius Go'onus from Elu Bolores Shabi Yehuda, we're not necessarily referring to the three rich people of Yerushalayim, because they were Baalei Tzedakah. Rather, we're referring to other rich people who refused to lend money, and therefore their power eventually got broken. But again, now with a Prusbel, they're more willing to lend money. Further on in the parak, it starts talking about dinim of avodim knanim. There's a number of takonis that the Chachamim made also in connection with an eved knani and a shivcha knanis, also mepnei tikkun olam, various things. So that leads the Gemara into a long discussion about various dinim of avodim knanim. But it has a connection with the Masechta anyway, because like this, when you free an eved knani, one way of doing it is with a shtar, and that shtar has certain similarities in halacha to a get that's given to a woman. So that's another reason why it comes up in this Masechta, and this area over here with several blocks that the Gemara spends on it is one of the major places in the Gemara where it talks about all the dinim of Avodim Knanim. Anyway, one thing it mentions in the course of the discussion is that there's a mitzvah essay in the Torah to keep an Eved Knani forever and implicitly therefore not to free him. La'olam behem ta'avoidu, the Pasuk says you should always keep an Eved Knani working for you, and therefore the Gemara says if a person frees an Eved Knani, then he's over on a mitzvah essay. Now, the Gemara mentions there are certain exceptions, sometimes when it is a mitzvah to do it. One example it gives is, for example, one time Rabbi Eliezer comes to Shul together with his Eved. He finds there isn't a minion, so he frees his Eved, and then now he can count towards the minion. If only it were so easy nowadays to make a minion, sometimes when we need it here in Shul, but anyway. Okay, so in this case, in this connection, the Gemara brings the following piece. Omar Rava or Rava, Bahami Tlas Mili Nachsi Balabatim Nechseim. Because of the following three things that Balabatim do, they end up losing their wealth. The first one, the Mapki Abdayu Lecherusa. The first one is because they free their Avodim Knanim. So therefore, so again, they're being over on this mitzvah sasei. Or deciding Nechsayu B'Shabsa. The second thing is because they look at their nechosim, they look at their fields on Shabbos to see what they need to do. Now, me'ikar adin, it's allowed. You're not allowed to speak about business or about weekdayish things on Shabbos, but you're allowed to think about it, technically. Nevertheless, it's not the right thing to do. It's like he's figuring, I have off work on Shabbos anyhow, so I may as well take a look at my field and start planning mentally for what I'm going to do with it after Shabbos. So now, Rava is saying that causes them to eventually lose their wealth. And the third one is the kavis or desayu b'shabsa the iden ve'medrasha. The third one is that they make their suda on Shabbos at the time when the chacham is darshaning in the beis medrash. They would have public drashas on Shabbos where they would teach people Torah. So these people make their suda. They time their suda for exactly that time. Where they should be doing it earlier or later. So what's the connection? How do these things davka cause them to lose their wealth? So Marsha explains, because it's like this. In the case of the Avodim, each one of them, then he's being over on something. When he frees his Eved, it shows that he himself is taking away from his Nechosim. He himself has property that Hashem gave him, including an Eved, and he goes and voluntarily frees him for no good reason. So it's like he's showing that I don't really need my wealth. As far as looking over his nechosim on Shabbos, so again, technically he would be allowed to, but nevertheless, he's not going to see a bracha in his nechosim because of that, because he still shouldn't be thinking about it on Shabbos. And Marsha refers over here to the story in Masechta Shabbos, where you have the flip, the opposite of that, a chosid echad who saw a breach in his fence on Shabbos, and for a moment he's thinking what to do about it, and then he catches himself and realizes, wait, I'm not supposed to think about that on Shabbos. And in the end, Hashem rewarded him by having a slash bush grow over there and cover up the hole, where also now it gives him a nice source of income. So here, this person is doing the opposite. He's thinking over on Shabbos, what can I do to improve my field and to improve my nechosim after Shabbos? And therefore, that means he's denying himself that bracha. As far as the Suda at the time of the drasha in Shul, so Marsha refers to the fact that the Gemara tells us in Brachas that the Chassidim Rishonim would spend a lot of time. They made their Torah, they made their learning Torah the primary focus of their day's schedule, and then okay, you have to go to work, so they would fit that in wherever it fits. This person is doing the opposite. He's acting as though the learning of Torah is less important. So therefore, again, he forfeits that bracha that Hashem would give in the Chassim, and therefore he ends up losing. In the chosin. Eitz Yosef points out other points as well, that like this, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that rich people in Bavel are zeicha to their wealth because they honor the Torah, and in other countries because they honor Shabbos. So now these people who are looking over their property on Shabbos are not honoring Shabbos, and the ones who are having their Suda at the time of the Drosha in Shul are not honoring the Torah. So there are different angles like that. Different other Mephoshim talk about different possibilities within that of what exactly it is, what exactly these three things have in common. But that's what the Gemara is telling us over here, that these three things are things that cause people to lose their wealth. And the Gemara continues, the Omer of Chir Ba'aba, Omer Rabbi Yechanan. Rabbi Chir Ba'aba tells us, in fact, in the name of Rabbi Yechanan, that Shtei Mishpachas Hoyu B'Yerushalayim, there were two prominent families in Yerushalayim, Achas Kovas Sordas B'Shabbos, one of them would make their main meal on Shabbos during the time when they're supposed to be in the Beis Medrash. The other one made their main meal on Erev Shabbos. Now, Rashi has two explanations. One is that it means they made their main meal Friday night. Now, with that, they're trying to gain that this way they won't be interfering with the time of the Drosha. The problem with that is, La Halacha, the daytime meal of Shabbos is supposed to be nicer than the nighttime meal. The daytime meal of Shabbos, even though we have a lesser kiddush by it, in terms of the actual meal, in terms of the actual food served, it should be more choshev than the nighttime meal, and they weren't doing that. Rashi's second explanation is that they would have a big Suda on Erev Shabbos. They were very rich, and therefore, so every day, including Erev Shabbos, they would have big banquets. The problem is that when you do it Erev Shabbos, then you don't go into Shabbos with an appetite, and therefore it shows a lack of covered for Shabbos. This past Friday was Purim. We had that issue, which is why we had to have the Suda somewhat earlier than usual in order to avoid that issue and not be going into Shabbos full and not be able to enjoy the Shabbos food. So according to Rashi, that was the problem with the second family, Shtei and Nepru, and the result was both families became uprooted. Both of them lost their wealth and lost their position because they showed a lack of respect for Shabbos or for the drosha of Torah on Shabbos, as the case may be. Further on, the Gemara spends, as I said, quite a few blot talking about various dinim of an Eved Ivri and of an Eved Knani and a Shivcha Knanis. So at one point, the Gemara mentions the point like this. Now, it's possible to have an Eved or a Shivcha who is Chetzye Eved v'Chetzye Ben Chodin. They can be half slave and half free. The obvious way would be if they're owned by two partners and one of them frees his half and the other one has not done the same thing. Now we know a yid is not able to do kiddushin with a shivcha knanis. She's out of the whole picture as far as kiddushin are concerned. The only one that the shivcha knanis is allowed to marry and have relations with is an eved ivri, as it talks about at the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. What about now if she's half free? Now, you have a din like this. Suppose a man goes to a woman and gives her a pruta and says, half of you is mekudesh to me. Does that work? So the Gemara says no, because to say half of you is mekudesh to me implies and the other half is available to be mekudesh to somebody, to be neskadesh to somebody else, and you can't. A woman can't have two husbands. So therefore, it's not a valid kiddushin. So now the Gemara says, Dora Shrava Barav Huna. So Shrava Barav Huna drew an analogy with that, and he darshin, Kashem Sha Makadish Chatzi Isha Ein Makudeshes. Just as if a man is Makadish half a woman, it doesn't work. Chatzi Shishon, Chatzi Bas Toyin Shin Eskadisha Ein Makudeshes. The same way when this woman is half slave woman and half free, then it would be impossible to do Kedushin with her. Amalei Rav Chista, but Rav Chista says to him, "Me dummy, how do you compare it? There's a big difference. Hosam shiur b'kinyanai, when it comes to the regular Jewish woman, when he says I'm mekadesh half of you, he's leaving out a part that he could have been mekadesh. He could have been mekadesh all of her, and instead he's mekadesh only half of her. So therefore, you could say it's not effective." But over here, he's being Makadish everything that he can. He can't be Makadish the half of her that's a slave woman, because she's out of the picture as far as Kedushin are concerned. So he's Makadish, whatever is available for Kedushin, why should that be invalid? So the Gemara says that Rabba Barav Huna accepted the argument. Hoder Uki Rabba Barav Huna Amurda Ilavei V'Dorash. Now he set up an Amurda in front of him to darshan in public. Now why, this is the first time Marsha points out, it didn't say anything about an Amurda. The way it used to work, as we have throughout Shas, is that a Chacham or a Rosh Hashiva or whatever, often when he's giving a Drosha to the public, he wouldn't say it loudly enough for everybody to hear. He would say it quietly and briefly to a Turgamon standing, also known as an Amurda, standing next to him, and the Amurda would speak out the details more clearly and say it loudly for everybody to hear. So now he set up an Amurda because he wanted to make the following announcement. Marsha points out that, first of all, one possibility is that they would only set up an Amurda only when they're doushing and psukim. He was going to quote a posik and doushing it, so for that kind of thing they would have an Amurda. As opposed to before, he was just saying a din. Another point, H. Yosef makes a point as well, is that he wanted to show everybody publicly that he had made, actually, Ion Yaakov says this, that he wanted to show he doesn't care about the fact that he's going to be embarrassed. It's, after all, more embarrassing that somebody else should say it about him than about himself. So therefore, he's going to go and doubt publicly that I made a mistake and I'm changing my mind. So he started his drosha with the pasuk, "V'amachshela azos tachas yadecha." The pasuk says, "This stumbling matter is under your hands." The context is that the Navi describes how there's going to come a point where the people of Yerushalayim are going to go over to a person, and they're going to say, "You seem to have the qualities of a leader. You should be our leader." The Gemara in Shabbos explains that it means just that. They tell him, "You seem to have the qualities of a Talmid Chacham. Be our Rav. Be our teacher of Torah." And part of what they tell him is "V'amachshela azos tachas yadecha," which means "Ein adam oimin al dibrei Torah elin ken nichshav behen." A person only really fully understands a concept of Torah only if he first stumbled over it. So in other words, the same way Rabbi Barav Huna is saying, because I stumbled, I made a mistake in this halacha, now I realize the facts. In the pasuk over there, by the way, the guy responds that, "No, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm not really qualified to be a rav or a talmid chacham at all." But the point is, in other words, that they're using, why they're using the word machshela azos for divrei Torah, that a person says something in Torah. It turns out that he was wrong, and he gets embarrassed for it, and then that makes him, that motivates him to realize it properly. So they tell him, "You are expert in such areas of Torah, so you should be our rav and you should be our teacher of Torah." So now, again, Rabbi Barav Huna is quoting this pasuk to say, "I'm in that situation. I went through machshela hazois, and now I'm going to clarify the halacha for everybody. Why is it taka that ein onam oimin al divrei Torah elam ken nichshav behen?" Again, there's a variety of explanations among Mefarshim. Among them are the embarrassment itself is a kapara for him, and therefore makes it more possible for him to learn Torah. And there's the fact that since Torah is chokhmosa ratzon shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the human mind by baderech hateva should not be able to assimilate it, but only when the person feels a sense of bitul is he able to, and this that he stumbled over it and was publicly embarrassed helps create by him that sense of bitul, and a variety of other reasons why it's often important that a person makes a mistake in something of Torah, and that itself gives him the capability now to understand it so much better. Anyway, so he says, and he goes on to quote Rav Chista's point that there is a distinction. A man is Makadish half a woman, it doesn't work, but a man is Makadish a chetzi shifra v'chetzi baschor, and it does work. And the difference is because in one case he's not being Makadish every part of her that he could have, whereas in this case he is. Further on in the Perek, it continues talking again, we're still talking about things that the Chachamim made Takonis Mifnei Tikkun Olam in order for society to function properly. So one of them is the Mishnah mentions about Dinim of Pidyon Shvuyim, that when a person is captured and taken hostage by Goyim, you don't free him for more than he's worth, because that's going to motivate the Goyim to do that again and again. This is unfortunately very much in the headlines now. And famously, we know Maharam Rutenberg followed this in practice when he was arrested by the emperor, by the German emperor of that time, and they were raising money to get him out of jail. He refused, and he quoted this, that you can't do that in Pernas Ashwinyas Mekdei Demeyim, because then it's just going to encourage the Goyim to do it again and again. It worked, by the way, because the attacker never tried it again, because they realized they didn't get anything, they didn't get the money they were expecting to out of arresting Maharam Rutenberg. So the Mishnah also mentions, for the same reason also, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, when you have people who are captured and imprisoned by Goyim, you don't try to help them escape. Because then what's going to happen is that then they're going to guard the other ones who are under their control all the harder, and they may even they may torture them or worse. So therefore, better if you can arrange with them to ransom them for a decent amount, then fine. But don't go trying to help them escape, because then they're just going to take it out much worse on the other ones who are there. Also, unfortunately, very negaya now. So the Gemara tells the following story about this point of Jews who were captured by Goyim and escaping. Now, you can't necessarily help them escape, but the prisoners themselves are certainly entitled to do whatever they can to escape. So that's borne out in the following story. The Gemara starts off, Binsei did Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman's daughters, Bachshin Kidu Rabbi Yadayhu. They were stirring pots with their bare hands. There would be a pot on the fire, and the contents of the pot are very hot. And they would stir it with their bare hands, and nothing would happen to them. So it seemed like they're tzidkonius. They must be on a tremendously high level of tzidkus that the fire doesn't affect them. But kashalelit of Ilish. But of Ilish found it difficult to understand how that could be. He said to himself, "Ksiv." The pasuk says, "Odom echad me'elof matzasi." I found one man in a thousand. That's an outstanding tzaddik of that kind of level. The isha b'cholayla le'matzasi. But even among that, I couldn't find any women. That there should be women who reach that level of tzidkus is a highly unusual thing. So what do you mean? How even more rare than by men? So he thinks to himself, "How he convinced that Rav Nachman?" Well, here you have the daughters of Rav Nachman, and daughters in the plural. There's more than one, so it seems that it's not such a rare thing. So what is Shlomo talking about? Well, the Gemara says, "Garmelay or Lahum Milsa." This matter caused them the Ishtabian that they were taken captive. Marshal explains that's just it. The fact that they were passing themselves off as Sidkonius, and as the Gemara is going to say at the end of the story, they were anything but. That itself caused Hashem caused them to be captured by Goyim in order for their true nature to be made known to everybody. So they were taken prisoner by Goyim. V'ishtaboy iunami bahadayu, and Reb Elish was also captured and taken captive together with them. Yoimachad have a Yosef Gabeahu Gavra. One day a certain man was sitting together with Reb Nachman. This person, I guess, was also a fellow captive over there. To have a yoda belishna ditzpori. This guy knew the language of the birds. He knew when birds are making noises and all. He knew what that signifies. Also uve v'kor korilei. And all of a sudden, a raven comes and starts calling to him. Omalei Maika Omar. So Reb Elish asks the guy, "What is the raven saying?" Omalei. So the man answers, "The raven is saying, Elish brach, Elish brach, Elish, run away, run away." Omar. But Reb Elish thinks to himself, "I'm not going to follow that." The raven is a liar. We find all the way back by the marble when Noach sent out the raven to check out what's the story. Has the water dried up yet? Then the raven didn't do its job. And it circled around and it wouldn't whatever. So therefore, so Reb Elish figures to himself that you can't rely on what a raven is saying. So why do you ask in the first place? One interesting point that Mephoshim says is maybe Fakir. He's thinking to himself, whatever the raven says, I'll do the opposite. So therefore, he wasn't going to listen to it, and he wasn't going to use that as a basis to say that he should run away. But then adahochi osa yonah v'kakaria. Then a dove came and was also calling and making and cooing and making noises. Omale maika omra. So again, Rav Elish asks the guy, what is it saying? Omale, and he says the same thing. Elish brach, Elish brach. Omar. So now Rav Elish thinks to himself, Knesset Yisrael ki yonah masila. The Jewish people are compared to a raven. Compared to a dove. For a number of reasons. A dove is always faithful to its mate, just like we're always faithful to Hashem. A dove, the Gemara mentions in some places, when it's attacked, then it fights with its wings, rather it fights or it protects itself with its wings, unlike, in other words, other birds fight with their claws or whatever. It doesn't. There's a number of points in that. It means that the dove flies away with its wings in the same way our wings are Torah and mitzvah. So there's a variety of reasons why we Jewish people are compared to a dove. So he thinks to himself, therefore he says, I can see that a ness is going to happen to me. Marsha points out, by the way, that it's not that he didn't believe the person when the person first told him that I understand the language of the birds and the raven is making these noises and saying run away. It's not that he's saying I'm afraid that you're a liar. He's just saying that the raven is not a trustworthy bird as opposed to the dove is, as we see also by Noach, that the dove faithfully fulfilled its mission. There's also the point, Mephoshim point out, since as the Gemara is going to go, the Gemara goes on to say that this guy ran away also, then we have to assume the guy is telling the truth, otherwise he wouldn't risk his own life on something that's not true, so it must really be that he understood the language of the birds. Omar, so now Rav Elish thinks to himself, Ezel echze binse de Rav Nachman, let me first go and check on Rav Nachman's daughters, e kaimen behemunusaihu, if they're still faithful to Yiddishkeit and to their husbands, adrinu, then I should help them escape also and bring them back to their husbands in Nahavda. How's he going to find out what's doing with them? Omar, he thinks to himself, Noshi, when it comes to women, kol mili de islahu, whenever they have private things they want to talk about, sadra mahadodi v'beis hakisa, they talk it to one another while they're in the bathroom. In fact, the Gemara mentions in Sanhedrin that at one point Rabbi Yossi made a takana that women should go to the bathroom. Remember, they didn't have bathrooms in their houses. A bathroom would be a latrine or something out in the open field, that they should go in groups of two or more. This way it would avoid a problem of yichud. This way they're going to be talking with one another, and any men who are nearby will hear their voices and he'll realize not to go there, and therefore there won't be a problem of yichud. So he figures the same way. Based on that, then they're going to be talking over there, and therefore I can listen in. Shaminu dekamin, he overheard them saying, Adi Guvrin, these guys, the Goyim who took us prisoner, are Guvrin, they're now our husbands. Now, obviously, the captors have been doing whatever they want with them all this time, but in other words, you know, you have, in English, they have something called Stockholm Syndrome, where sometimes, unfortunately, people who are captured by terrorists or by whatever start identifying with them. So now these women are in the same situation. They're thinking of these Goyish captors as now these guys are now our husbands. Well, Nahadoi Guvernin, and back in Nahadoi, we had our old former husbands. Let's tell the Goyim who originally took us prisoner and who knew now whom we have feelings, let's tell them that they should take us far away, from here, otherwise our husbands from Nahada are going to hear that we're in this area, and they're going to ransom us, and we don't want to be ransomed. We'd rather stay here with these bandits. Well, so Rav Elish realizes that obviously they're not faithful to, it's not an onus anymore, now it's berotzen. So therefore, so there's no sense in trying to get them to come with me. At this point, we can't help it. We have to give up on them. Tom Orak, so he went, got up to run away. Also, Ihu Vahu Gavra, and he, Tom Orak also, he started going and running away. Ihu Vahu Gavra, he and this guy who understood the language of the birds. The day Rav Elish was able, Ness happened for him, over Bamabra, he was able to successfully cross the river, and now he's safely away from the captors, from the bandits. Vahu Gavra, Ashtachuva Katlua, the other guy, the bandits caught up with him and killed him, and Ness didn't happen to him. Whether he was a Yid or a Goy, it doesn't say one way or the other. eventually, ki hadran vasoyan, eventually these women did come back. Marshall points out they didn't come back voluntarily. We just said that they were saying to each other, we'd rather just stay with these bandits. Eventually, apparently, their husbands did find out where they were, and they arranged to ransom them, so now they came back. Omar, so now Rav Elish realizes what was going on all this time, Havokabash and Kidra Bekshofim, the fact that originally they were stirring those pots with their bare hands is they were doing it through the power of Kishruf, not that they were Tzidkonius. So now he understands. I was wondering how it comes that they're such exceptional Tzidkonius, that they can have an open thing happen like that, that they're impervious to the fire. No, the real reason is because they were accomplishing that through Kishruf. We talked about a day or two ago that Rav Nachman, actually, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, was married to the daughter of the Reish Galusa, who was the governor, the minister of Jewish affairs in Babel. I don't know, but it's possible that maybe it means, in other words, not always do we find the Reish Galusa were such great people. Maybe that, unfortunately, had a bad effect on the daughters and caused them to go off the derech like that. I don't know if it says anything like that one way or the other, but it's a potential svara. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ula. What is this? What is today? You test
other days. No, you test rather.
So La'asid Lavoi, it's the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Malachim that La'asid Lavoi, all the Jewish people will be great chachamim. So what does that mean? That we'll be great chachamim. It means not just in Torah. It means that all the chachmas will be restored to us. So we won't need the chachmei umas anymore. For example, the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh that all the details he explains over there about how to calculate the positions of the sun and the moon, the phase of the moon, and all that necessarily, he says, has to be based on books by Greek astronomers, by Greek and Arab astronomers, because he says the original svarim that were written on that subject by the chachamim from Shevi Yisachar, we don't have them anymore. But now, these chokhmas will know them through the Torah. Similar to, we find a story in Masechet Bechoras where Rabbi Yeshua deduces how long a snake's pregnancy lasts from psukim. Unlike the Gemara mentions over there, the Goyish scientists of that time who tried to learn that by observation, the real way that we'll know these things, lost in love, will be from the Torah itself. Continuing on, Erev Chaseres. So we've been talking about the whole concept of schiras reshus from a goy. So now, if you have a Yisrael mumer, a yid who unfortunately has converted to another religion, or is mechal Shabbos for Fahesia, and the Alter Rebbe adds, we don't mean, for example, just that he was in a hard situation. It was mechal Shabbos. We're talking about a person who's regularly mechal Shabbos. Yes, Omrim, and the Alter Rebbe agrees with this, even if he's only Mechal Shabbos in Yisurim Derabbanan, then for this purpose he's considered like a goy, and you would need schiras reshus from him as well. Whether that applies to nowadays people who don't keep Shabbos because they don't know better in Tinukas or Tinukas Shanishvu, that I'm not sure about. I think that in general we say that the Tinukas Shanishvu, we say Lechumra, but not Lekula. But so that would mean, in other words, over here to say that they're considered like a Yid would be a Kula, and you don't need Tzchiras Rishus, but I'm not sure about that point.